from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. It seems like everywhere you turn, technology is making life easier. Sometimes it seems you can just lean back and let a machine or a computer do what used to be backbreaking or time-intensive work. But where does it end? Today, the Golden Gate Bridge went all electronic, collecting tolls with computers and scanners instead of human beings. Companies all around the world are investing in software and products to make more human jobs virtual and digital. Are we rendering ourselves obsolete? Would that be such a bad thing? In this hour, we'll consider the future of work and whether there's any way to keep a robot from taking your job. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. Good morning. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Retired General Eric Shinseki once said, "If you don't like change, then you're going to like irrelevance even less." Truer words were never spoken, at least in terms of today's workforce. It used to be that countries worried about other countries taking their jobs. Today, all countries may be developing something that can replace us even better. Robots. Depending on who you ask, humanity is heading for something like Star Trek or like Terminator. Star Trek, the utopian future where robots and computers allow us to pursue greater and higher things. Terminator, the nightmare scenario where our machines render us not only useless, but defenseless. Granted, those are extremes, but people are losing their jobs today, right now, to increasingly automated industries. In this hour of Forum, we'll explore the future of robots at work. And we'll consider whether we should be making ourselves indispensable or preparing to move on to something else. Joining us today are Andrew McAfee, Principal Research Scientist at the Center for Digital Business at MIT's Sloan School of Management. He's the author of Race Against the Machine. Andrew, good morning.
Morning, Joshua. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us. Also with us is Martin Ford. He owns a software firm in Silicon Valley. He's the author of Lights in the Tunnel, Automation, Accelerating Technology, and the Economy of the Future. Martin, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Later on this hour, we'll talk to some researchers who are teaching robots to perform complex surgeries and fly through space. And we welcome your questions and thoughts. Feel free to call us at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. And you can also comment on our Facebook page or send us a tweet. We are at KQED Forum. Andrew, let me begin with you. Where do you think we're headed? If you had to bet on either Star Trek or Terminator, most likely, which one is the clearest picture for our future as it stands right now?
Let me reframe the choice a little bit. I don't like the Terminator outcome because to me that implies that the machines are going to become so smart they declare war on us. I don't see that happening at all. I think the choice is somewhere between Star Wars and the old H.G. Wells War of the Worlds, the Time Machine story, where there are this class of Eloi and the Morlocks, the kind of small upper class in this huge subterranean race of troglodyte people. The choice we have is whether we want to create something that looks a lot more like a utopia or a lot more like a very unequal dystopia with our technologies. I hope and pray that we're headed toward the utopian version.
Martin Ford, let me put that question to you too. And I know Star Trek and Terminator are two very big, very oblique examples. But just broadly speaking, where do you think we're headed right now on the track that we're on at present? What do you see as our near future?
Well, I agree with Andrew that I'm not too worried about the literal Terminator outcome where, you know, machines threaten us physically. I don't see that as something that's likely, certainly not in the near future. We would all hope that it would be a more equal society and that we'd head for that utopian outcome. But on the track we are right now, I mean, there are definitely reasons to worry. We are, you know, headed toward a society that is becoming increasingly more unequal. And where I think more average people are going to really struggle. And if we don't ultimately take some action to turn that around, then we're probably headed to a more dystopian outcome.
Let's dig deeper into that. Andrew McAfee, paint us a picture of where we are today. I don't think that most people who have been displaced necessarily think, you know, there's a machine taking my job. I mean, manufacturing, a lot of the manufacturing jobs that have become automated and mechanized, that's already happened. It seems like a lot of what's happening now happens in terms of virtualization, in terms of using fewer computers to do what more people previously did. You paint me a picture of where this stands now in terms of not just computers, but actual machinery, advanced machinery doing jobs that people used to do.
Yeah. So over and over again, we see that the machines are taking people's jobs. And we can use a bunch of terms like machine or computer or robot. I put them all in the same lump of digitally based stuff that is incredibly powerful. And a couple of quick examples of that, I learned that out in your neck of the woods, the toll booths on the Golden Gate Bridge are going to vanish completely. It's going to be a totally automated system.
That happened today. That's true.
I learned today that they're planning to do exactly the same thing in my state on the Massachusetts Turnpike. Now, we used to think that toll booth collector was kind of a hard job to automate because you'd have to design a machine that could handle bills of different denominations and coins and all of that. And it turns out that you don't. All you need are a bunch of very powerful digital cameras to take pictures of the license plates as they go by and a network that's plugged into the driver registration systems in Massachusetts and all the other states to send people a bill if they don't have the right transponder on it. That, to me, is a pretty clear example of machines taking away jobs from people.
Martin Ford, as you own a software company in Silicon Valley. How are you seeing this? Has this impacted you at all as a business owner? I know that you deal mostly with software, so it may not be so much a matter of machines taking over the work, but how have you seen this play out?
Well, the overall trend has certainly impacted my business. I mean, when I began working, you know, 10, 15 years ago, there were jobs for lots of average people doing lots of average things. I mean, at that time, software was shipped on disks or on, you know, CDs, and there was typically a printed manual that went with it. I mean, there was a lot of tangible things to move around and ship and fulfill and everything. Nearly all of that has gone away now. It's all digital. It's people download software. It's delivered directly to them. The way that we produce things like advertising and so forth is completely different. A lot of the jobs that used to be there are simply gone, and it's all, you know, automated.
Let me take this from the perspective of I know we're going to talk about the technology and people in high-tech professions more as the hour goes on. When I thought about this story, I thought about people like, say, my dad, who owns a carpet cleaning business, and his line of work is completely automatable now. I mean, you can buy a Roomba that will clean your carpet and will remember the dimensions of your house. So the kinds of blue-collar jobs that people like some in my family and many families do seem like the kind of work that is much easier to automate, to teach a computer to do by rote or maybe by a small bit of learning. What happens to those folks who are further down? Andrew McAfee, let me put this to you, who are a little bit further down on the knowledge worker food chain. When their jobs get cut, presumably first, what happens to them?
The historic answer is that they do lose their jobs for a while, but then what happens is really clever innovators and entrepreneurs see new market opportunities. They create new companies and new industries, and those industries need a lot of labor at all different skill level. So even though we've seen really serious waves of automation and technology before, we have not seen periods of long-term mass unemployment as a result of them. The thing that kind of keeps me up at night is the thought that this time might be different, and because machines are so capable along so many different dimensions, that I start to feel that the innovators and entrepreneurs of tomorrow might be starting up new companies, new industries, doing their work, but just not needing a lot of people to accomplish that. And in that case, a lot of the people who get displaced are going to have real trouble finding gainful employment again.
We're speaking to Andrew McAfee, the principal research scientist at MIT's Center for Digital Business, and Martin Ford, a Silicon Valley entrepreneur who wrote the book The Lights in the Tunnel, Automation, Accelerating Technology, and the Economy of the Future. 866-733-6786. Let's go to the phones now with Max in Oakland. Max, good morning.
Hi. So I see it's sort of a dichotomy here in terms of where the pressures are. One thing that's really important to me is in many ways, this is not about what the robots can do. It's about who owns the robots and who reaps the benefits. And there are a couple of different things going on there. One is that for about the size of a car, you can buy, for instance, a robot woodcutter. So that actually empowers a small business person, as opposed to, you know, the massive job losses that we see in the auto industry, where, you know, you just can't start up a car factory and you're gonna just lose lots and lots of jobs as a result of automation there. Another thing I'm curious about, as far as what your guests think, this is actually pretty important, taxation. In a world where so much labor is done with robots, does it make sense to keep payroll taxes as a source for government funds? And should we look at transitioning to another method of getting that money?
Max, thanks for the question. Let me put that to you, Martin Ford. What do you make of those economic aspects of this ever more robotic workforce?
In terms of the machine ownership, absolutely, that's an issue. But it's going to, you know, we know that that's going to be very unequal. There may be opportunities for small business people and for what we might think of a kind of a craft economy where people can own machines and do useful things. But for the most part, you know, the ownership of the machines is going to really accumulate at the top and it's going to make us all more unequal. In terms of the taxation, I think that's absolutely right. In fact, that's a specific point that I make in my book, is that I think we'll need to shift away from payroll taxes and in general, taxing labor, and we're going to have to find a way to put that tax burden on businesses that are more capital intensive, because, you know, basically labor is going away and machines are taking on more and more, and so, you know, there's just simply not going to be a base there to support our social safety net.
Let's go back to the phones now with Tom in Petaluma. Tom, good morning.
Good morning. First of all, I wanted to say that the previous caller I thought was right on. My observation is that technology, basically our capitalist system, which is technology-driven, is neither sustainable economically or environmentally. We keep putting additional pressures on our natural resources to create more and more, which is technology-driven. We eliminate jobs in the process, which creates problems. And for every new technological advancement, it introduces dozens more problems and usually eliminates hundreds of jobs. That's my observation.
Thank you, Tom. What do you think about that, Andrew McAfee?
I believe about capitalism something very close to what Winston Churchill thought about democracy, which is that it's the worst possible system apart from all the other ones we've tried. And the whatever environmental problems arise in our capitalist societies are nothing in comparison to the horrors brought on by collectivist systems and communist systems. I think our capitalist system has done an astonishingly good job of improving the quality of our lives, bringing us into an era of abundance, and overall, with the exception of global warming, taking increasingly good care of the planet. So the last thing I ever want to advocate or propose is moving away from the system of property rights and free enterprise and innovation and entrepreneurship that we have. It's one of the world's great success stories.
You gave a very interesting TED Talk that I hope we can post it to our Facebook page about this very subject. And one of the graphs you show has to do with human population and kind of social well-being, an index of social well-being. And you mark all these different points, you know, the advent of Christianity and the discovery of this thing and that thing and certain empires and eras, and the point at which human population and social well-being skyrocket is the Industrial Revolution. So it seems like your argument is that if history is to repeat itself, that this next wave can only kind of take us exponentially higher to areas we can't even really fathom right now.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. It's a fundamental point, and I was blown away when I first realized this. You can actually graph human history over a really long time period. You can graph things like social development, how advanced our civilizations are, how many people there are on the planet. It really doesn't matter. When you graph human history, you learn that there has basically been one story, because the graph is horizontal, kind of no progress, no real advancement, and then it goes vertical. And it's just astonishing to look at. It goes vertical right in the wake of the Industrial Revolution, which is a technology story. It's the story of us overcoming the limitations of our muscles. My point in the TED Talk is what we're doing right now is overcoming the limitations of our minds to at least as great a degree. If we don't fumble this, this will take us into an era of unbelievable abundance and affluence and variety, and take us into, as you say, the Star Trek, this utopian future.
We're talking about whether robots are taking a toll on jobs or whether they will be a boon to the workforce, discussing it with Andrew McAfee of MIT Center for Digital Business and author Martin Ford. We're going to bring in two guests during the hour who are working with robots doing some incredibly cutting-edge work. One of them is with us right now. Dr. Catherine Moore is the Director of Medical Research at Intuitive Surgery. It's the company that developed the Da Vinci surgical robot, which, among other things, can repair heart valves. Dr. Moore, good morning.
Good morning, Joshua. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for making some time for us. I know we have some amazingly capable cardiac surgeons in this country who do wonderful work, who've been doing this kind of work for years. What is it that the Da Vinci robot can do that a surgeon, even a really, really good surgeon, typically cannot?
Well, you can't really think of the robot as doing the surgery, but really more augmenting the surgeon's capability to do that surgery. Because the surgeon is at a console, and they are making motions with their hand and being able to see inside the body. And the robot is essentially just taking those motions that the surgeon is making, scaling them down to a very small and precise scale, and allowing them to do the kind of manipulation that they wouldn't be able to do at the scale of their hand.
So you still have to have a skilled doctor. It's not like this robot is doing the surgery on its own automatically.
Yeah, in fact, in some ways, this is almost the opposite of automation. In automation, you've got real-time decision-making being made by the computer and real-time motions being made by the robot. And in this sort of more augmented, using robots to augment the surgeon, the real-time decision-making is being made by a surgeon, but we're augmenting the capabilities and the motion that they're capable of doing.
What kind of impact does this have on the outcome of the surgeries, the quality of the surgery, recovery time, success rates? What impact has this had?
Well, it's used in a lot of different areas, and the impact varies by the surgical area that it's in. In most cases, what you're doing is allowing the surgeon to operate through very small incisions, but be able to do all of the same surgery that they would be doing on the inside through a large open incision. And so the recovery times are a lot faster because most of the recovery is associated with the large incision that you're making. For the cardiac surgery that you mentioned, that recovery period is particularly profound because instead of having to split the sternum, go through the main bone in the chest, instead you can go in between the ribs to be able to do that kind of surgery.
What kind of reaction do you get from surgeons when they encounter the Da Vinci robot? Has it been positive, negative, skeptical? What's the reaction been like in terms of them being able to do their jobs as they see fit?
It runs the entire spectrum. Some people are initially very suspicious of the technology. They say, you know, I don't need this to be able to do the excellent surgery. It adds nothing to me. Others look at it and say, if I can do all the same surgery that I would be able to do through a large incision, through these very small incisions with better vision, this is going to make me a better surgeon. And those are the ones that are really embracing the technology.
What would you say is the next new development as you're working on the Da Vinci robot? What can we expect to see in the next 5, 10, 15 years in terms of the next evolution of this particular technology?
Well, one of the things that people tend to ask about a lot is, are we going to be adding any sort of automatic suturing or that sort of thing to the robot? And the answer to that is no. Really what we're anticipating over the next several years is adding more technology that improves clinical decision making and improves people's ability to make a decision. So we have near-infrared fluorescence imaging, for example, that will allow the surgeon to distinguish between cancerous tissue that they want to take out, or blood vessels, and hopefully in the future, nerves that they would like to be able to leave in, and allow it to be more obvious where they should be cutting. We also want to integrate things like preoperative 3D imaging, again, so that people can support clinical decision-making during the surgery.
Dr. Catherine Moore is the Director of Medical Research at Intuitive Surgery, the company that developed the Da Vinci surgical robot. Dr. Moore, this sounds absolutely fascinating, very interesting, cutting-edge research, and I appreciate you sharing it with us. Thanks for talking to us.
Well, thank you very much.
We're going to go back to the phones now as we come up on the bottom of the hour. Please feel free to keep calling in, 866-733-6786, or email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. Actually, let me go to a few emails before we go to the phones. One listener writes, machines have been replacing human labor for a few hundred years. What is different this time is that the tech companies have decided to outsource the job of making these robots and automatic teller machines to countries like China. More money for the shareholders and fewer jobs for Americans. Brian in San Francisco writes, jobs are for people, not machines. Automation largely only benefits those who own the machines. A rising tide lifts only those who own boats. Everyone else is left to drown. Let's take a call from Jessica in Oakland. Jessica, good morning. Hey, Jessica, are you there?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm here.
That's all right. Good morning. What's on your mind? Briefly, we're almost up to a break. Briefly. Go ahead, Jessica. Looks like we couldn't quite get Jessica. Let's try Melvin in American Canyon. Melvin, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Of course. What's on your mind?
Well, my question is this. Over the last 20 years, we've seen the middle class lose its earning power, basically through technology. And if you accelerate this process, I guess the question would be, who will be the customers for all this tech? Because, as in China, the workers there can't afford iPads. So who will be the customers for all of this technology that's to become, you know, the de rigueur for the new future?
Good question, Melvin. Let's put that to Martin Ford. Martin, what do you think?
Well, you know, that's a very good point, and it's that's really the main thrust of my book, is that I really focus on that. There is a tremendously powerful feedback loop between the money that people earn through jobs and what they can spend. And what we're seeing is that it's becoming more and more concentrated at the top, not just in terms of income, but also in terms of consumer spending. Right now, the top 5% of consumers in terms of income are doing nearly 40% of the total spending, and there's every reason to believe that will become more and more extreme.
Martin, I'm sorry, let me interrupt you for a second, make sure I got that right. The top 5% of consumers are doing 40%, 40%
right,
of the spending?
Right, in the high 30s, yeah, 37, 38%,
wow,
something like that. So it's becoming, you know, it's what's been dubbed the plutonomy by analysts at Goldman Sachs, actually. So we've got a very unequal economy. And the question becomes, as that progresses and it gets worse, are you going to run out of consumers? I mean, ultimately, it's not just about dollars, but it's about units. It's about how many people there are out buying things, because we have pretty much a mass market economy. Most of the major industries that you can think of, whether it's manufacturing or services, they're industries that cater to millions and millions of people. They need lots of prospective customers, not just a couple. So, you know, it is important that we have a reasonable distribution of income throughout the economy. So we may have to come up with some alternative solutions to make that happen as this issue progresses.
Yeah, and I'm sure that's going to impact the way that we pay wages as well, to make sure that people can continue to be a part of the consumer economy. But we'll continue that conversation on the other side. We're discussing robots and the future of work with Andrew McAfee from MIT's Center for Digital Business and Silicon Valley business owner Martin Ford. We'll continue the conversation with you as well. Feel free to email us, forum@kqed.org. You can call us, 866-733-6786. You can also comment on our Facebook page or send us a tweet. We are at KQED Forum. When we come back, we'll talk to a scientist from NASA, who is teaching robots to do something that human beings can only do inside a shuttle, fly through space. Cool stuff. We'll continue on the other side. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. Welcome back to Forum from KQED Public Radio. I'm Joshua Johnson from KQED News, sitting in for Michael Krasny. We're talking about the future of work as robots and computers continue to do more of the jobs that human beings used to do. Let's talk with a man who is teaching robots to do some new things that maybe human beings can't or have never done. Mark Massiri is a research scientist in the Intelligent Robotics Group for Carnegie Mellon University and the NASA Ames Research Center in Silicon Valley. He helps develop Android-powered robots that can fly freely through space. Mark Massiri, good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. This sounds like absolutely fascinating work. Give me an example of one of the things that you are teaching robots to do in space that maybe might be unsafe or just unfeasible for a human being to do.
Well, so the work that we're doing is primarily on the International Space Station, which ends up being a pretty unique environment in that it's in microgravity. So unlike down on Earth where everything tends to stick to the floor or the ground, our robots actually fly through the inside of the space station. And so that requires special software and special sensors and other things to allow ground controllers and astronauts to be able to tell these robots what they want them to go do. Some examples of what they do, we're looking at the robots being able to provide camera views for ground controllers. So the idea of kind of a flying camera that ground controllers can take around the station and go look at things instead of having to have crew do everything for them. Much like earlier in the program, you had mentioned Roombas vacuuming houses and things like that. There's a lot of just kind of menial and boring tasks that you have to do on station. And so we're looking at all kinds of different things that robots may be able to do to help alleviate some of those tasks from astronauts and allow them to do a lot of the more interesting science.
Now, to be clear, we're not talking about robots doing the mission critical functions of being in space, right?
Well, it depends on how you define mission critical. I mean, one of the kind of most important things that you do when you're in space is making sure that the environment is safe and that it can support the livelihood of the astronauts that are on there. So you have to do things like monitor radiation levels, and you have to monitor audio levels and other things to make sure that you don't have long-term health effects and other things that may be affecting the astronauts. And we're actually looking at having the robots be able to do some of these tasks and do them automatically, or maybe even do them while crew is asleep. And in that way, you know, the robots aren't getting in the way or causing any trouble. You can think of it as everybody goes to bed, and then the robots come out and basically do a day's worth of work while everyone else is sleeping.
Well, let's take it a step further. If robots can work when everyone's in bed, couldn't they presumably work when everyone else is still on Earth? I mean, why do we need to send astronauts up at all if we could just create a fleet of robots who can do the same kind of scientific research under more extreme conditions with less of a need for recharging and regeneration? Why have astronauts at all?
So the human component here is just very, very important. You know, one is just, you know, it is at least a lot of us around here believe that this is, you know, part of what mankind was kind of destined to do, to explore the universe and other things like that. The other thing is it helps for a human being to be there and observe the effects of what's happening when they're doing the science. You know, robots, even in the future, I have a hard time imagining a world in which the robot is looking at something and creating a hypothesis for some science that's happening and then drawing conclusions. I mean, science is very much something that's a human activity right now. And so at least in the role that NASA has kind of taken is we think of the robots as assisting the human beings in doing what they're going to do in space as far as the science goes.
So even on the cutting edge of science, the point of exploration is still that we want to go explore.
Correct. And you can think of the robots not only as being kind of co-located or being there while the humans are doing it, but, you know, we have robots right now that are on Mars that are scouting out and telling us what is the conditions on Mars that may be able to sustain life. What we know what human beings will need to live on other planets or to work on the moon or other bodies out in space. And so you can kind of think of the robots as, you know, that there are surrogates that are out there right now and helping us gather this data. Now, once the humans are out there, then you have the robots that are co-located with the humans and kind of working with them. But then if, for instance, we were to leave the moon or Mars after doing the science where humans were out there, then, of course, you're going to want to leave the robots out there to continue on,
right,
and kind of working forward even after we're not there anymore.
Well, it's fascinating research. As a kid who grew up not far from the Kennedy Space Center, I think spaceflight is just one of the coolest things ever. So this is very interesting, cutting-edge research. Mark Masiri is a research scientist in the Intelligent Robotics Group for Carnegie Mellon University and the NASA Ames Research Center in Silicon Valley. Mark, best of luck to you with all your research, and thanks for talking to us.
Cool, thank you very much.
Let's continue the conversation on the phones, 866-733-6786. Eric in San Francisco. Eric, good morning.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
On the top of the hour, we talked about the context of this conversation, and I think that's really important. It's funny that we don't lament changes in technology, in material science, in medicine, but somehow the conversation here is lamenting progress in information technology and robotics, which is, as a former Carnegie Mellon University faculty member, is pretty scary. And as a resident of Silicon Valley, something that's pretty scary. I think it's really important to give people proper job training, but you think even a knowledge worker has to change skills over time. You think somebody trains in the 60s on Fortran is going to update their skills over the decades.
I would hope so. I would certainly hope so. Now, since I have you on the line, can you drill down into that a little bit further? Because this is an area I'm not familiar with, so you can teach me something right now. Give me an example of, you know, you said Carnegie Mellon, you have a very advanced degree, of an aspect of this kind of work that would force someone, even in a high-knowledge business with tremendous access to information, to say, whoa, I have to go back to the drawing board and start learning all over again. Give me a specific example.
So the rise of machine learning over the past decade has enabled a suite of tool development and companies that weren't available to be produced a decade ago. Amazon's cloud is now used in a plurality, but I'm thinking even a majority of startups in Silicon Valley. And that enables companies that weren't around a decade ago. I was able to start a company in recent years that just based on innovations in math and computing, based on machine learning, that wasn't available to me a decade ago. A decade ago, what we taught is discrete math, and now we teach learning algorithms. A decade ago, we used to teach a little more programming, and now statistics are what is taught.
Eric, that's good insight. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Andrew McAfee from MIT Center for Digital Business. Let me put that to you. What about the jobs at the very top of the knowledge hierarchy? How's that going in terms of people being able to cope with robots and computers, even maybe displacing them someday?
Well, we had a great example of that earlier this hour with the Da Vinci robot, which requires surgeons to substantially change their skills. I know that Watson, the Jeopardy champion supercomputer from IBM, is being applied to healthcare, and that will require doctors to realize that they might not be the best diagnosticians in the world anymore. But I think Eric, our caller, made a really important point that I want to return to. We are in danger of lamenting progress when we talk about all the downsides of the robots taking our job, and that is just a terribly bad idea. Progress is something to be celebrated. It allows us to have more leisure, more abundance, more fulfilling lives. And if you don't like progress, to me that kind of means you'd prefer to have your chest cracked open every time you need to have your heart operated on. I wouldn't.
Let me go to a few emails. Wanda in Palo Alto writes, what, if anything, can the computer revolution do to ameliorate the rapidly growing divide between the downward-headed middle class and the rapidly accumulating population of extremely rich people? Martin Ford, let me put that question to you.
You know, I don't know that technology itself can solve that problem. I mean, there's a lot of evidence suggesting that technology is going to accelerate that. It's going to worsen it. That doesn't mean that I think technology is bad. I agree with Andrew that technology makes us more wealthy, but we clearly have a distributional problem, and that problem is going to get bigger. And I think the way to solve it is probably in our economic system and in our political system, rather than looking to technology to solve that for us.
A few more emails. Brian in Richmond writes, we use computers as robots every day to automate office tasks that are repetitive, monotonous, or otherwise impossible to do manually. This amounts to a revolution of productivity, whether it's software or physical robots. David wrote on our website, this topic is inseparable from a discussion about ownership. I like the image of an employee-owned company that replaces its human labor with automated labor and allows its employees to derive income from capital ownership. But we all know what happened to the Joads when the combine harvester arrived. Automation will mean emancipation or irrelevance, according to who owns the machines. Let's go back to the phones. Jenny in San Francisco. Jenny, good morning.
Good morning. I think technology is great, and it opens up so many wonderful new worlds for us that we don't even know about. But I feel like there's times when it just isn't, it's actually less efficient. For example, just an everyday example, I go to the grocery store, Safeway in particular. They've eliminated 6 checker positions for an automated checkout line, which nobody knows how to use. That is the longest line in the store. All the other lines are long. The checkers are able to get people through the line faster than this automated thing. And so it seems like the people are losing, the customers are losing, the people are losing their jobs at Safeway. You know, maybe the bottom line of the company is being enhanced, but the people really aren't getting served.
You know what? There are some people in the control room nodding in agreement with you on that, Jenny. But because I've encountered that too. But you know what? I will tell you this. Something I found in our recent reporting, in one of Safeway's most recent quarterly reports, they're actually, it seems like the way they're making money now is through that Safeway card that is helping them. And the Safeway cards and debit cards and gift cards, those digital services that allow them to cater to you more specifically, I think, I'm guessing that's kind of what Safeway's banking on rather than you learning how to, you know, swipe a barcode.
Right. And it's too bad because I love the checkers at Safeway and they're just like sweating and the lines and nobody's happy. And it's just, it's kind of a shift. And, you know, the grocery store is kind of a place where people, you know, whether they're tech savvy or not, want to go and shop. And it's just, it's kind of depressing.
It's, yeah. You know? And there are some great checkers out there. You're absolutely right. Jenny, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Let me take a few more emails, include one. Let me get to this one from Joe. Joe in Santa Clara writes, I am finding this discussion very superficial. There is a major problem here facing society, yet you are dwelling on examples such as the surgery or the space robot, which have little impact on middle-class jobs. What about the autonomous trucks, which were discussed a couple days ago, and all the truck drivers, which were going to be made redundant? Martin Ford, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, it's a good point. I think the thing that I really focus on is that the jobs that are really threatened are going to be the ones that are more routine and people doing more predictable things. And it's not necessarily going to be about skill level. You know, we tend to focus on skills and we say, you know, what you need is to get more skills so that you can protect yourself from automation. That's not necessarily the case. There are going to be a great many very highly skilled jobs that are nonetheless kind of routine and predictable based on what's been done in the past, and they're going to be, you know, definitely threatened. And the reality is that most people in the economy probably, you know, really the lion's share are doing jobs that are on some level fundamentally routine, and that's certainly true of the broader middle class. So that's the problem that we face, and I think that's primarily what's different about the past. I mean, in the past, technology has destroyed whole industries, and people have found new jobs, but they've moved from doing routine things in one area to routine things in another area. That's going to change in the future because a lot of those routine jobs are simply going to go away and people are going to have to adapt in ways so that they're doing something that's fundamentally non-routine. And that's you know, going to be a real challenge for a lot of people. And it's also, it may be a challenge to create jobs of that nature for you know, sufficient people. So it's a big problem.
And I think adapting also means re-educating. You know, a lot of people are going to have to go back to school that haven't been in a classroom in a very long time and maybe just squeaked by, and now it's going to be the linchpin that kind of makes the difference as to whether or not they can even be part of the future economy. Another email, Paul in Sunnyvale, makes a very worthwhile point since we talked about the Da Vinci robot. Paul writes, what Catherine Moore did not mention is that the Intuitive Surgical robots are assembled by humans in Sunnyvale, California. Let's go to another call. Lynn in Alameda, good morning.
Hi, I have a question with respect to this use of robots in surgery. I can, on the one hand, see that this is great if it reduces the amount of time you need for recovery from an illness, and this could be a cost-lowering technology with respect to healthcare costs. On the other hand, given our reimbursement system, I could see it as being a cost-raising technology. So is it cost-lowering or is it cost-raising? Are we going to continue the upward spiral in healthcare costs, or do we see this as a possible way of helping to reduce those costs in the future?
Lynn, that's a good question. Andrew McAfee, what do you think?
What is going to reduce prices to us over time is a combination of technological progress and competition. There is nothing that drives down your prices more than a competitor breathing down your neck. And when you look at the parts of the healthcare system that are not part of this reimbursed fee-for-service, you know, we'll pay you back for as many things as you want to do, you see incredible improvement in cost. LASIK eye surgery is one of the best examples there.
Didn't you have an example, I'm trying to remember from your TED Talk, Andrew, about there was a village, correct me if I'm wrong, a village in India, I think it was, that finally got cell phones for the first time and the impact that that little bit of technology had on the overall quality of their life, including the money they were spending, and actually improved their economic future. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. When we look at the bottom of the pyramid, and there have been wonderful, careful studies done about what happens to people when they get these 21st century technologies for the first time, where they were living in a digital vacuum and therefore an information vacuum. When you look at what happens when they get these technologies for the first time, the step change, the step improvement in their lives is really amazing when you document it carefully. So I hear what our earlier caller was saying, and Martin in his book and Eric Brynjolfsson and I in Race Against the Machine focused on this issue of job losses and the pressure on the middle class and some of these challenges that we face with inequality. But I do want to underscore, I want to keep saying this, technology is one of the great forces improving our world these days. I honestly can't think of a bigger one.
Let's go to another call now. Shana in Oakland. Shana, good morning.
Hi, good morning. It's such a fascinating conundrum here. And one of the things I want to question is the assumption that unchecked abundance and unchecked progress is an incontrovertibly good thing. Obviously, there are great things that come from technology. I don't think that there is anybody who would really say that, you know, medical advances have not, by this point in life, led to them even being alive in the first place, given how long we've had such advances. But the ever-increasing abundance and accumulation of wealth in general, even despite, you know, increasing disparities in wealth, is not necessarily a good thing for the planet, for ecosystems. Unchecked growth in population, unchecked growth in, you know, consumerism, this is not a good thing, and there's more and more research that's coming out around climate change, around waste, et cetera. And I think that that's something that is not being addressed. There's a requirement to keep on accumulating stuff if we're to keep this system going that leads to, you know, more and more advances in technology and in robotics. And that needs to be addressed in this conversation.
Shana, that's a good point. Thank you very much. It also dovetails with a point that was made by someone else who wrote online. Don wrote, one of your guests, and he doesn't refer to which one of your guests grossly distorted the enormous environmental damage to the planet from technology. To take just one prominent example, hundreds of thousands of square miles of floating plastic larger than the state of Texas, presumably referring to plastic floating in our seas and oceans. Let's take another call now. Mary in Moraga. Good morning.
Good morning. I thank you for taking my call. I have to say this is something I deal with quite a lot in my job. I'm an ergonomist, which I help companies not have strains and sprains and repetitive motion injuries. And so a lot of times manufacturing plants and things like that will call me in to try and come up with ways that their workers won't get injured. And so, you know, most of my clients aren't really ready to do the full automation yet. So I'm, you know, constantly, so luckily, I hate to say this, I'm not usually getting rid of people's jobs, but sometimes, you know, I am, you know. And there was one instance in Santa Rosa where I was there, and this company had, it was a recycling plant, and I've been to a lot of recycling plants where they use the air, you know, the blowing of the air and the magnets and all that kind of stuff, and you pretty much just get rid of all the workers, and these are the lowest-level workers you would think probably on the pay scale.
Right.
And this company decided not to do that. They, you know, gave full benefits, and even though I'm the one always pushing automation, there was a part of me that, you know, was really felt like, wow, I really respected this owner.
So just so I don't miss your point, it sounds like there's that human element. Obviously, we have the choice as to whether or not we want to use the robot or keep the human being, and that not all employers are going for increasing automation.
Right, and he did it specifically because he didn't want to lay off people. And, I mean, and even though I'm the one not wanting workers to get injured and, you know, all the stuff that happens at a recycling place, you know, I you know, there was a part of me that it kind of went, you know, it hit me in the stomach saying, wow, that's really cool that this owner, you know, get rid of all those workers and go the automation route.
Since I have you on the line, before we move on, as an ergonomist, what is the one biggest tip that you give to the most employers in terms of improving their workplaces, the comfort of their workers, the efficiency? If there's one overriding thing that most employers are doing wrong that they should be doing better, what is it?
Well, you know, this comes back to what we were talking about, and I'll just put it forth in a question. What's the right way to lift a car?
Hmm.
And they always say, you know, well, with a jack, with a lift, right? Right. So, you know, at what point do our bodies, you know, can they not do this job? And who's going to know what that line is, right? There's a lot of studies on that. But, you know, if you cannot have to do the job, eliminate it.
and that's 100% effective. Engineering controls, 33% effective. Administrative controls, 10% effective. Hmm. You know, so you go down the line, training on proper lifting techniques, probably the least effective.
Gotcha. Mary, I really appreciate the insights. Thanks very much. I know we're coming up near the top of the hour, running out of time. Let me go to a few more emails. Steve writes, as a hand craftsman, I think plenty about how my way of working is inevitably becoming even more obsolete. Beware overcoming the limitations of the body, and especially the limitations of the mind, as your guest mentioned so enthusiastically. A human is built for hand-eye problem solving, and it is naturally satisfying. It's a tragic, ironic loss. We still work all day, but at more and more stupid and meaningless jobs. Chip writes, if someone's job is taken over by a Roomba, why don't we just reduce everyone else's hours of work? That's what I'd call labor savings. This is an analog to the ownership problem, but focused on the distribution of time. Like an earlier caller said, why do we need to keep growing anyway? Let's just work less, spend more time with family, as the cyborgs take over our jobs. Martin Ford, what do you make of that? Should we just let the cyborgs take over the jobs?
Well, if we can solve the distributional problem, then you know that would be great. I mean, we'd all have lots of leisure time. But the problem is that left alone, that isn't what's happening. Rather than sharing the work and all having more time to do what we want to do, what's happening is that some people, in fact, maybe a lot of people, are going to be cut out entirely, and they'll have nothing to do. And what's of more immediate concern is they may have no income. So we need to. You know, to solve that problem. And it's probably not a technology problem, but it's really an economic and a social and a political problem. And certainly some form of job sharing may be, you know, a big part of the solution to that.
Let me ask the quality of life question. Andrew McAfee, I'm trying to think about, before we did the show, I was trying to think about what areas of our lives that robots and technology just would not take over, and that are uniquely human, that human-to-human interaction is just so important we wouldn't allow it to change. And other than something like, I don't know, the Renaissance Fair, like I can't think of anything really where people would just totally blanch at having anything that high-tech invade. What do you see in terms of the boundaries for where we as human beings would just say, actually, no, we'll handle this ourselves?
Well, I've still never seen what I would call a creative computer. I've still never seen an innovative one. I've never seen an entrepreneurial one. I've never seen a really empathetic one. So I do think that human beings still have some skills to offer an employer, to offer the economy. So I don't see this day coming when the robots are just suddenly going to be able to do everything that we do as well as we do. There's this constant encroachment into our bundle of skills and abilities, but we still hold the high ground in some very important areas.
Let me also ask you both about the legal implications. Some of our listeners have pointed out that Intuitive Surgical, which makes the Da Vinci surgical robots, is being sued for allegedly not training the physicians who use it to use the robots adequately. Apparently, a patient had died while being operated on by a Da Vinci robot. Now, we're obviously not sure who's going to come out in the right on this, but what sort of new, Martin Ford, let me ask you, what sort of new rabbit holes and legal problems do we run into when we advance and let a robot do what used to be a uniquely human job?
Well, there are definitely, you know, certain areas where it's going to be a big issue. Another area where it will be big will be automated cars. You know, if you have a car that's in an accident and it's automated, then who do you sue? In general, one issue is that when you manufacture an automated device to do perhaps some aspect of medicine, or whether it's an automated car, there could potentially be tremendous liability, because you would be taking on liability that used to be distributed across, you know, thousands or millions of people, and you know, it becomes centralized in one area. So that's a real issue that we're going to have to solve. So there are definitely, you know, legal and you know, a lot of other things that besides just the technology that may act to sort of slow this down in certain areas.
Let's see if we can squeeze in another question before we run out of time this hour. Tricia in Sacramento. Tricia, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I am wondering where that line between human interaction and robots starts and ends. No one wants to hear from a robot that they have cancer and it needs to be removed. The robot might do the work, but you still want that human interaction, that social, that emotional support. So is that where we fit in? But I'll take my take the answer off air. Thanks.
Cool. Thanks, Tricia. Let me add to your question a comment that I think dovetails. Nicole from Oakland writes, what about the terrifying military robots built for war? Battle is a decidedly undesirable occupation, but what are the moral and ethical repercussions of using digital mercenaries to kill? Andrew McAfee, let me roll those two into one question in just terms of the human aspect of certain jobs, that the human empathetic piece that makes certain professions, certain functions what they are, can become washed out when you let a machine do that kind of work. How do we reckon with that?
Well, I think Tricia makes a really great point. I don't want to hear my cancer diagnosis from a screen or from a robot. One of the really important and fascinating areas going forward is putting together the right combinations of human and machine skill and ability to deliver fantastic new things for us. An ICBM is an automated weapon. It's not that different from a lot of the battlefield drones and robots that we're thinking about. What I haven't heard anyone in the military talking about yet is giving that robot the authority to act or to shoot or to kill on its own. That's still a human judgment, and I think it should be.
Right. So Skynet is not going to become self-aware anytime soon. I appreciate the conversation from you both. We are almost out of time. Martin Ford, briefly, before I let you go, give me an example of one thing you're looking forward to in terms of the possibilities with what robotics and computers might be able to do for us to help us maybe move on to more pursuits, do our business better, or just live better lives. Very briefly.
Well, I think it will invade everywhere. I mean, I think that people will be able to leverage digital technologies to build businesses, to do more creative things in their daily lives. If we can solve the issues with the impact on unemployment, I think it's very positive.
Gotcha. Martin Ford, author of The Lights in the Tunnel, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
And Andrew McAfee of MIT's Center for Digital Business, I appreciate your time, sir. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Forum is produced by a bunch of humans. Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Susan Britton. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our engineer today is Danny Bringer. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Thank you very much for listening. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.